Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
I'm Ken Burden. I am a partner at Skadden Arps in the investment management practice. And our other panelist that we have with me is Lauren Smith from Fidelity. She's senior legal counsel there. So today we're going to talk about the basics of an investment management practice with a particular focus on registered investment companies, which are regulated under the Investment Company Act 1940. So I'm going to share my screen here. We'll have a nice slide deck to go through. All right, great. So this is our intro, of course, and then we'll just jump right in here and talk about what is an investment company. So an investment company is at base a company that issues securities and invests in securities. So unlike your IBMs or your Googles or your Facebooks or your X's, an investment company doesn't have any operating assets. What it has is securities of other companies. So it's just this pool of securities, and it gets managed by an investment advisor and serviced by a variety of different parties, which we're going to talk about kind of in depth on the next slide. So the funds own the assets, as I mentioned, are the securities of these other companies. And then it has contractual relationships that help it manage and conduct its operations. So typically how these companies get set up is an investment advisor such as, you know, Lauren's employer, Fidelity, will sponsor a new fund. They do all the work to set it up. They get a board of directors. They hire an investment advisor, which is usually Fidelity. Then there are other types of service providers that we're going to talk about on the next slide that they set up arrangements with. And then they start operating the company. So the investment companies here are regulated by the Investment Company Act, which is which unlike other federal securities laws, you know, contains detailed governance and operational requirements. So you may be familiar with the Securities Act and the Securities Exchange Act. Those are both disclosure statutes. So what they say is, in order to go publicly sell your securities to the public, you need to, you know, meet certain disclosure requirements, and then it imposes a variety of liabilities if you commit fraud or otherwise a bad actor. What the Investment Company Act does in addition, which is unique in the federal securities laws, is it also acts as kind of a quasi-federal corporate governance statute. And that has a lot of different implications that we're going to end up running through. And then the one other thing that I think is really important just to keep yourself focused on as we talk about the Investment Company Act is where it's grounded in history, right? And this is, we always go back to the history. Why was this particular provision included in the Investment Company Act? Why did we think it was important? And really what the Investment Company Act grew out of was the abuses in the investment company industry during the 1920s. And these generally involved insiders benefiting themselves at the expense of public investors. And there's a variety of different ways that the statute tries to get at that problem, from the construction of the board of directors to prohibitions on transactions with affiliates and other things that we'll get to as we come through our deck here. So on to the next slide. This is a diagram of what an investment company looks like. So you see at the middle there, we have the fund, which is a pool of assets. And then we've got all these people that are around that pool of assets to help service it. So Lauren, kind of from that in-house perspective, this must be an interesting process to manage. So I thought I'd turn it over to you to talk a little bit about what this looks like and kind of how you deal with all of these different constituencies.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement, Ken, that it is an interesting process to manage. And I think this is an incredibly helpful graphic to get a sense of how many different players you have in the day-to-day management and operation of a fund. And I think what's important to keep in mind is that the fund itself does not have employees. And so it relies on all of these service arrangements and oversight functions for its day-to-day operations. And so, as Ken said, in the center here, we have the fund, which is the pool of assets managed by an investment advisor. Funds are organized under the laws of a particular state, which we'll talk about a little bit later. And as Ken said, funds issue their own securities to investors or shareholders who pay money to the fund in order to have that ownership interest. And they also take that pool of assets that they get from their investors and invest those assets in other securities, or debt instruments or other types of investment instruments. So the fund is both issuing its own securities and investing in other investment instruments. As Ken said at the beginning, the fund is managed and kind of set up and arranged by an investment advisor. So as Ken said, I work at Fidelity. So Fidelity acts as the investment advisor, has a number of different investment advisors that act as the registered advisors to our investment companies. And there is a contractual arrangement governing that. So you'll have a management contract between the fund and its investment advisor. And the investment advisor is, hired by the fund. It has to be approved by the board, and it's responsible for the day-to-day investment and the reinvestment of the fund's assets based on that particular fund's investment strategy. And I just said the advisor is approved by the board. You'll see the board kind of sitting above that fund graphic on this page. Every fund has a board of directors or a board of trustees, depending on how it's organized. And as Ken was saying, arising out of this, the historical abuses and conflicts of interest in the way that funds were set up, the board's role is to act as a fiduciary or a watchdog, right? And look out for the best interests of the fund and its shareholders as the fund is going about its day-to-day operations. And we'll get into the details a little bit later, I believe, but generally, the board of directors will be comprised of a majority of independent directors, so folks who are not insiders or interested persons to the fund and its various service providers. Other than the advisor and the board, we have a number of other entities here that are involved in the day-to-day operations of the fund. So you have the administrator. This is a service provider that handles back office operations, right? So the fund's books and records. And for example, this would be the entity that would be responsible for calculating the fund's daily net asset value, so pricing the fund. Sometimes this is a function handled by the investment advisor. Sometimes there's a completely separate entity that does this. So in the case of Fidelity, we have a separate affiliated administrator that handles the fund's books and records. There is also a custodian for every registered fund. This will not be an affiliate. This is typically a bank. So think State Street, BNY Mellon. And this is an entity that's responsible for holding and safekeeping the fund's assets. And again, this goes back to the idea of preventing some of the abuses that happened in the 20s. In this case, the ability of an insider to the fund being able to take the assets invested by the fund's shareholders and run away with them, right? Use them for their own benefit or do with them what they will. So you take those assets and they get held by an unaffiliated custodian. There is a transfer agent. This could be an affiliate or not an affiliate. And their role is to keep track of the fund's shareholders and their share ownership in the fund. So they keep the shareholder list. They make sure that they know the number of shares that each shareholder holds. If the fund is paying dividends and distributions, they will keep track of that on the fund's books. So really important function with the transfer agent and making sure that you actually have record of who is a shareholder in your fund. And then we have the fund's underwriter. And this is a broker dealer, often an affiliated broker dealer, that helps to sell the fund's shares. So someone has to help with the actual distribution of the fund's shares to shareholders. And that's the role that the underwriter plays. And then for this audience, since we are doing a presentation at the BBA, you'll see a couple of circles here for different types of counsel. So we have fund counsel. And as the name suggests, this is legal counsel to the fund itself and sometimes also to the advisor. And they're helping with legal issues that might arise in the fund's day-to-day operations. But you also would have independent counsel. So this is separate from fund counsel. It is someone typically from a completely different firm. And their job is to act as counsel to those independent trustees as those trustees are going about their day-to-day fiduciary obligations and overseeing or acting as a watchdog for the fund's operations. So two different types of counsel. And then, of course, at a firm like Fidelity, we have our in-house counsel that works closely with the investment advisor and often with fund counsel on day-to-day legal issues that arise in the operation of the fund. So I will pause there and see, Ken, if you had anything you wanted to add or if there are any questions on this, because that's quite a lot of information about all the different players in the fund universe.
Yeah, and as we're waiting to see if anybody has any questions, I'll just mention there's one other kind of way to set up the outside counsel relationship. So me being outside counsel, I'll kind of bring that perspective here a little bit. So one typical way is as Lauren described, where your fund counsel really represents the advisor and the funds. And they're going to be the principal people that the in-house counsel will interact with on a day-to-day basis on legal issues. And then, of course, the independent counsel being the counsel to the independent directors, which we will talk about in a slide or two, are a requirement to have for an investment company. Another way you can set this up that some firms do is you can have the fund counsel and independent directors counsel be one and the same, and then that law firm will not represent the advisor. So in order for the independent directors counsel to be independent, they can't do any meaningful, substantial work for the investment advisor. So some firms will be kind of dual fund counsel and independent directors counsel, and then they just won't work for the advisor. Some that works for some firms like mine, that doesn't work. We prefer to be fund counsel and advisor counsel so that we aren't knocked out of work for the advisors. Seeing no questions, let's move on and talk about, again, kind of popular forms of organization. I don't know, Lauren, do you want to kick us off on just, you know, kind of how the funds are organized from a state law point of view, maybe talking about Fidelity, and then I can give a little background on some of the other forms of organization?
Yeah, absolutely. So investment companies, as Ken said, are formed under state law. They are trusts or corporations. It usually depends where you decide to set up. The most typical places that you will form an investment company is Delaware, Massachusetts, or Maryland, really due to more developed or more favorable, I think it's both, you know, tax and statutory regimes in those states for the operation of an investment company. For Fidelity, we are primarily in Delaware and Massachusetts. Fidelity is a Boston-based company. That makes sense. I don't know that we have any Maryland-based funds, but we have a pretty good split between Delaware and Massachusetts. It is important to know that not all funds are registered investment companies. So not all funds that you encounter out there are registered like a mutual fund or an ETF or other registered companies under the 40 Act. And we have a couple of examples of exemptions that you'll find under the 40 Act. I think the ones that folks are most familiar with are, you know, what are referred to as private funds. So hedge funds, venture capital funds, private equity funds. These types of funds typically rely on exemptions from 40 Act registration based on the number of investors they have or the sophistication level of their investors and the fact that they're not typically making public offerings, right? They have private offerings and they're really trying to stay out of the regulatory regime because there is a lot that you have to do as a registered investment company, you know, disclosures and other obligations that you have to your shareholders that these funds are trying to stay out of. There are other exemptions under the 40 Act, right? Banks, broker-dealers, insurance companies, there are different types of exemptions they can rely on to avoid registration and regulation under the 40 Act.
Yeah, and what's interesting perhaps for this audience is that the original, you know, investment company was the Massachusetts Trust or the Boston Trust or the Boston Trustee, I guess. But what grew out of that was this concept of a Massachusetts Business Trust, which to this day still doesn't really have a basis in statute in Massachusetts. It's just a common law entity that the courts recognize. And it's fascinating that a multi-trillion dollar industry has grown up around it. So then what Delaware did and what Maryland did was take that a step farther and say, hey, we like this trust concept because it's very flexible. It lets you essentially write your own corporate statute to govern your entity. So Delaware enacted a statute, which, you know, kind of provides for the legal existence of the trust in, you know, kind of the corporate law of the state and some default rules to the extent you don't address it in your declarations of trust. Delaware and Maryland tend to do battle in terms of the level of flexibility that they give you. And then when it comes to the corporation, the actual Maryland corporate law is quite friendly to investment companies as well. And they have very specific provisions that make the corporate form instead of the trust form, flexible in a reasonably similar way to a trust, though I would say not as flexible. So moving on to common features of all public investment companies. So would you like to kick it off, Lauren? This is where we start to get to the really fun stuff.
I was literally just going to say this is the fun stuff. So things that you will find across public investment companies. A majority independent board of directors or board of trustees. So we've mentioned this a couple of different times. You need this in order to operate your fund. In order for the fund to be able to operate, you need a board that has a majority of independent or disinterested directors who can take action on behalf of the fund and approve things like contracts with all of your service providers. You have, for all funds, restrictions on certain types of transactions with affiliates. This is really complicated and very broad. So not only are you restricted with transacting with affiliates, but you also are restricted in some cases in transacting with their affiliates, so affiliates of affiliates. And this all goes back to what Ken talked about at the very beginning of this presentation, in that Congress is really trying to make sure that insiders to the fund are not taking actions that are not to the benefit of the fund and its shareholders or that are otherwise benefiting insiders to the detriment of the fund and shareholders. So we're mitigating potential conflicts of interest with these rules. And there are various different types of prohibitions under the 40 Act. Some examples here. So there are restrictions on what we call principal transactions. This is when a fund trades directly with its affiliates. So it's buying and selling directly with an affiliate of the fund. There are agency transactions. And so this is when a fund is using a broker that is affiliated with its investment advisor to conduct transactions. So using an affiliated broker, for example, to buy equities. And there are prohibitions on joint transactions. So this is when a fund and its affiliate are both trying to profit from some type of transaction or arrangement. So like a fund and its investment advisor engaging in a transaction together. There are, and I think we probably get into this a little bit later, there are always exemptions, right? There are certain exemptions that you can rely on to be able to conduct transactions that you might not otherwise be able to, subject to certain conditions. There is always or often the ability to go to the SEC to ask for relief, right? If there's something that you would like to be able to do that is not permitted under the 40 Act, but you think there is a basis for being able to do so in some of these cases. But typically, you should be aware that that when you're acting as counsel to a registered fund, you always have to be thinking about these restrictions under the 40 Act and whether your fund is doing anything that could trigger one of these restrictions. So I'll pause there. I don't know if you wanted to add anything at this point, Ken. I know we have a slide with a lot more detail later on.
Yeah, just a couple, like, you know, again, broad overview points too, that, you know, the independence of the board is like super independence. And just the one thing to come away with here is that if you're direct, so you've got a, as Fidelity is a private company, but think about a BlackRock, a big publicly traded company. Any director who wants to be an independent director of one of the BlackRock funds can't own one share of BlackRock stock.
Yep.
So that's the level of independence that we're talking about here. No even hint of a conflict of interest can be present to be an independent director of an investment company. And then with the transactions with affiliates, again, it's like super affiliation, right? Under the Securities Act and the Securities Exchange Act, the concept of affiliate is usually a control relationship. Right. So either I control you, you control me, the same person controls us. Right. Affiliated person here, you know, can mean someone who owns as little as 5% of the fund, or someone that the fund owns as little as 5% of. And then you have to go look at all that person's affiliates. Right. So you just kind of can take the extreme example of, you know, some company owns 5% of the fund, and then that company owns 5% of something else. Well, the fund can't transact with that something else under the Investment Company Act. So those are the kinds of, you know, issues that come up when, you know, as Lauren says, you're going to go, you know, the fund's going to go try and do a transaction of some sort, and you have to think about these issues. And there's a big compliance infrastructure that goes with that, which, again, we'll get to. So I guess moving on to some more common features. Lauren, did you want to take this one as well and kind of run through a couple of these?
So I think the bullet at the very top here is incredibly important, right? This is one of the most critical functions that your independent board is going to perform with respect to the funds. So all public investment companies have an advisory contract, or if they have sub-advisors, multiple advisory contracts between the fund and its investment advisor that needs to be approved by the board and renewed each year. And cannot be changed materially without going out to shareholders in a proxy to get their approval to change it. So a big part of the board's job and its fiduciary function is looking at these advisory contracts and looking at the fees that are being paid under these advisory contracts and getting comfortable with them, right? Based on information that they can request, information that's provided to them about the investment advisor, and making sure that they're doing that and approving those contracts on an annual basis. There are, for all public investment companies, restrictions under the 40 Act in investing in other investment companies. This again, and this was like, I think the theme of this whole presentation, going back to preventing abuses and conflicts of interest that can arise when you let a fund invest in or do whatever it wants without some sort of oversight. So in this case, the restrictions on investing in other investment companies is meant to avoid complex layering of structures and complex layering of fees that a shareholder to a fund would have to bear. So think of a mutual fund that invests in a mutual fund that invests in another mutual fund, right? So you have multiple layers of funds and all the fees that get paid for investing in those funds that are being borne by shareholders. It is not a complete prohibition on doing this. The 40 Act has statutory limits that you need to be aware of. And as always, there are exceptions to those limits, right? So you can rely on certain rules or other exceptions under the 40 Act to exceed the statutory limits. But at a very high level, it's making sure that you are not getting overly complex in the way that you are structuring your fund and in the fees that the fund is bearing. I saw you come off mute, Ken. I don't know if you have anything you want to add there on those first two points.
I think that's great. And the point about, you know, exceptions on investing in other investment companies is an important one. And I know it's an important one for what you specifically do. But that itself could be an hour long webinar. So
we will. Yes. Yep. Yeah. My job at Fidelity is I support a fund family that is in part a fund of funds. So there is a lot of investing in other funds. So we are intimately familiar with the prohibitions and the exceptions to those prohibitions and how they function together. But I agree, that's a whole separate webinar.
Good. Did you want me to take compliance?
Sure.
Sure. So another big part of running an investment company is having a good compliance program. So, you know, the standard is you have to have a compliance program that's reasonably designed to prevent violations of the federal securities laws. And there's a rule under the Investment Company Act that says the independent directors have to approve it. The independent directors have to approve a chief compliance officer and have to approve that officer's compensation. So again, it's another way for there to be independent checks and balances on the operation of the investment company. We mentioned here a code of ethics that addresses personal securities transactions by personnel involved in running the funds. So you can imagine there's a conflict of interest between, for example, the portfolio managers wanting to purchase you know, things for their own account versus purchasing securities for whatever investment company they run. So there's a whole code of ethics that helps govern those conflicts and when trades can happen and when they can't. Lauren, was there anything you wanted to add from an internal point of view on the compliance function? I know that's a big part of what goes on the inside as opposed to what we see inside.
Yeah, the compliance function is really, really important, right? Having a strong compliance function means that you are setting yourself up to not trigger, right, any of those restrictions or limitations that you'll find under the 40 Act for the fund. And the CCO role is a particularly critical one. I know we internally spend a lot of time looking at reporting, board reporting, right? The CCO is very involved in making sure that the board and the independent trustees are kept up to date on the fund's compliance program, on various pieces of data and information that the board needs to be able to evaluate how the fund is operating and how that compliance program is operating. So it's a really critical function and one that we spend quite a lot of time and effort and energy on to make sure that it is running smoothly and that the board is receiving the information that they need to make sure that they are comfortable with the fund's compliance program and how that's operating.
All right. Thank you. So then the next slide here is talking about kind of the registration of investment companies. So we keep talking about a registered investment company, as opposed to a hedge fund or a private equity fund. All right. So what do you have to do to register this investment company? Well, you have to file a notification of registration with the SEC, and you have to write a prospectus that you file with the SEC. And the prospectus is split into two parts. One is kind of the prospectus, and one is the statement of additional information. So there's been an ongoing, you know, effort to try and simplify prospectuses for your normal mutual funds, to try and condense the information to what's really important. Because we as lawyers like to put a lot of stuff in there, cover everybody from a liability point of view in terms of saying, well, we disclosed that. Well, then some of the important stuff gets lost. So there's been an effort, you know, over time and over several rounds of SEC rules to try and really get that down to what's important. So if you're looking at a mutual fund right now, there's a couple different things. There's a summary prospectus, which is just a few pages long. And then there's a statutory prospectus, which has somewhat more information. And then there's a statement of additional information, which then has a lot of extra information. So if we're thinking about kind of disclosures about risks, they would go from, you know, kind of three or four sentences, then to maybe a paragraph or a paragraph and a half, and then to six paragraphs all on the same thing, talking about everything that you could possibly want to know about, I don't know, investing in debt, right? So those are kind of your registration documents. There's a few different types of investment companies besides your usual mutual funds. You'll see we have mentioned on here closed-end funds and BDCs, which are business development companies. If we have time a little bit later here, we're going to talk about what those types of funds, you know, are and how they differ. But here we're just talking about there's a different form that you have to register them on. So, of course, the prospectuses contain detailed information about investment policies and restrictions and a variety of other operational aspects of the investment companies. Now, we did get a question that, you know, aside from the 40 Act, how prevailing is ERISA in investment management? So for registered investment companies, it's not too prevailing because of the way ERISA interacts with registered investment companies. All right. So if an investment company is registered, I believe there's some type of exemption under ERISA that kind of just lets you comply with the 40 Act. It's much more prevailing when you're talking about the private funds, the hedge funds, private equity funds, and there's a lot of, you know, structuring around whatever, you know, ERISA issues might arise when you bring in a pension plan as an investor, for example. So that's a little bit outside of the scope, but just to kind of touch on it, you know, once you're a registered investment company, you know, usually, concerns around having, you know, ERISA investors go away. So this is just a little bit more on kind of what goes into the registration of an investment company. You know, picking the fund's name is particularly important. You know, picking whether policies are considered fundamental is particularly important. So fundamental policies are policies you can't change without a shareholder vote. So, you know, a lot of times, you know, you kind of have to balance the certainty of what the, you know, policy is going to be versus the flexibility of being able to change it if, you know, market or economic conditions change, or you want to repurpose the fund into something else, or into a different strategy, for example. And then in terms of names, it's very interesting. There's a big focus on names and what they communicate to the market. So we've got some rules here. I'll try not to get too into the weeds here, but generally, if the fund's name suggests it focuses in a particular type of investment or investments in a particular group of industries, you have to have a policy that says you're actually going to invest in that. And there's a new SEC rule that has come out and isn't effective still for about another year and a half, which kind of expands what gets pulled into that. So usually it would be if, you know, you're the Fidelity Gold Fund, right? You'd have to invest in gold, right? But if you were the Fidelity Gold Growth Fund, right, you would still just have to invest in gold. But now under the new rules, it pulls in these other concepts of, you know, investments that have particular characteristics is the catchphrase, right? And so growth is one of those particular characteristics. So the advisor and the fund would have to go and figure out some way to define what a growth stock is, and then go make sure that is what's being invested in pursuant to the policy. I don't know if Lauren, you had anything to add to that?
I think just that fund names is something that we spend a lot of time thinking about upfront. When we're going to be launching a new fund for the exact reasons that Ken gave, right? If you're communicating to a shareholder that your fund is going to have be focusing on a particular segment of the market, you need to make sure that your registration statement when you draft it reflects that. And I think it's important to understand that fund prospectuses and registration statements are living documents. This is not a one and done document. This is something that gets updated at least on an annual basis to make sure that you are reflecting the ever shifting kind of risks and focuses of the fund to the extent that they have changed. And they can be updated off of that annual cycle as well, to the extent the fund is making a change in strategy, or there is something else that needs to be communicated to shareholders. So this is an incredibly important document that you will spend a lot of time working on upfront at a fund launch, but will continue to spend a lot of time working on for the life of the fund. It's not a set it and forget it set of documents.
Yeah, that's a very important point, because we all know that, you know, every year we're coming, every year you have to look at this document and every year you have to update it. And there's a very strong process around that. And I think that's an important point for everyone to understand. So how do the investment companies sell their securities? So we're just going to touch on this a little bit because it gets into what are the types of funds. And so we've got some more detailed slides and discussion on that. But, you know, as Lauren was saying, your normal mutual funds are continuously offered products and they need a continuously updated registration statement and prospectus to keep that offering going. So, you know, with open-end funds or mutual funds, you know, you see your typical kind of alphabet soup of different share classes. You may hear people talk about A shares or B shares or C shares or R shares or T shares or I shares as you get more experience in the industry. These are all different share classes in one fund that offer different distribution dynamics, right? So, you know, the shares are sold through different distribution channels and those different share classes are designed to finance that in the way that channel likes to see. For closed-end funds, it's like an open-end fund. It's still a pool of assets. The difference is closed-end funds don't sell their shares continuously in the general course, right? There's always exceptions to the rule, as we've learned, but generally closed-end funds do an IPO, just like any other operating company, and then their shares trade on an exchange. And what that allows them to do is it allows them to remain more fully invested. They have a permanent pool of capital that can be invested and that investors can't redeem, right? So that's the other major feature of an open-end fund, is that you can submit a redemption request any day and get back the value of your shares. Not so for a closed-end fund. In order to get out of a closed-end fund, you have to go find somebody to trade it with on the exchange. So you'd submit an order through your broker like Charles Schwab or Fidelity or whomever, and then it would trade on the New York Stock Exchange. And there's advertising rules, and occasionally FINRA gets involved. So we kind of touched on these periodic filings here, as Lauren was talking about, you know, this 485B POS is the kind of SEC terminology for what the annual update to the prospectus is. Some closed-end funds are continuously offered too, and so they also have a comparable rule. Funds do periodic shareholder reports, that's form NCSR. So we're not trying to get too into the weeds here with anybody, but if you start practicing in this area, you're going to see these acronyms all over the place. And when you are asked to go look at a shareholder report, you want to go know where to find it. So if you go onto the SEC website, you want to know that, well, the annual reports are on N-CSR, and then those are the filings that you go take a look at. And SEN is kind of like a check the box data filing. And PORT are the portfolio holdings every quarter. And then there's some other miscellaneous forms for proxy voting and for money market funds. And of course, listed closed-end funds are just like any other public company. So they have annual meetings, and there's a proxy statement for that annual meeting as well. Is there anything generally you wanted to add, Lauren, in terms of, you know, the filings and the process, or anything that it would be helpful for folks to know?
No, I think you pretty much covered it. My experience with these filings is that there is an enormous, at least at Fidelity, internal infrastructure that supports these because of how many different types of filings there are. Obviously, the larger your fund complex, the more that you are supporting from a filing perspective. And there is a lot of time that is spent ensuring that the information that's included in those reports is accurate information and is comprehensive information, right? So if you end up practicing in this area, that will be something that you will likely be learning a lot about and focusing on, right? What goes into these reports? What is the timing of these reports? And how do you ensure that the data that you're including is accurate and up to date?
Wonderful. Thank you. And so what's a mutual fund? All right, we've been talking about this thing, right? So a mutual fund is a type of investment company that sells their shares on a daily basis at net asset value. You can redeem any day on demand at net asset value. And you buy and sell from the fund itself, not over an exchange. And mutual funds, because of these features, right, because they have to stand ready to answer your redemption request any day, they have to have a relatively liquid portfolio priced daily, and they can't have more than 15% of their assets in illiquid assets. Did you want to chat a little bit about liquidity, Lauren? I mean, that's a super important thing to talk about. And if
I know we have a slide, I think, on liquidity, right? Yeah, if we want to jump to that.
Yeah, I'm just going to jump to that.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think as Ken said, because a mutual fund has to be able to redeem shares on demand, and there is daily ability to redeem shares, you can't have all of your fund in illiquid assets, right? What money would you use to redeem out shareholders that are ready to sell their shares? So there are rules and regulations that talk about limits on illiquid investments, and you know how you meet a redemption request. And as Ken said, you can only have 15% of your fund's assets in what are considered illiquid assets. And there is an infrastructure around this, right? Like the SEC has come out with rules that have explained what makes something illiquid, what makes something liquid. And so at Fidelity, we have committees that have valuation policies that help categorize, right, when you bucket something as liquid or illiquid or somewhere in between, so that you can make sure that from a compliance perspective, you are not exceeding that 15% illiquid bucket. And when shareholders try to redeem out of your fund, you have sufficient liquid assets to be able to meet those redemptions. And I think that's what at the bottom, Ken has a bullet on Rule 22E4. This is the risk management program, the liquidity risk management program, where all of this work happens, right? Where you're looking at what the fund is holding, taking those holdings and bucketing them into different categories and overseeing what the fund is holding on a periodic basis to make sure that you are not exceeding any of the liquidity limits that the fund is subject to.
Right. And I mean, I think that should tell everybody how important this concept is of liquidity. I mean, there's a whole rule on it. You know, you have to have a relatively well-established set of procedures to monitor it and to test it on a frequent basis. And then when you start to fail certain liquidity metrics, you have to start reporting it to the board, to your board and to the SEC. So again, this is a very, this is a very important aspect of running an open-end mutual fund. So we of course should talk about ETFs. ETFs are open-end funds. The difference is that you can only buy their shares in blocks called creation units. And you can only redeem shares back to the fund in similar blocks of, I guess, redemption units, right? And the only people that can do that are typically your banks, who are called authorized participants. And then what the banks do is they buy that block, right? And then they split it up and then they trade it to you and me on the exchange. And so when you and I are buying an ETF, that's what we're doing. We're buying it on the exchange traded fund. We're not buying it from the fund itself. Only the bank that sold it to you is buying from the fund itself and is only buying in big blocks. ETFs are, they're an interest. I've always found them to be an interesting example of the way the 40 Act works, because, for years and years, they were built on exemptive orders that the SEC granted. I mean, you had a $1 trillion industry grow up on the basis of SEC exemptive relief to make it work under the Investment Company Act. And then that eventually turned into a rule, not that long ago, that most ETFs can rely on now. So I've always found that to be an interesting story of how the 40 Act has got this kind of very rigid corporate governance structure from a federal level, yet also recognizes that markets and the economy innovate, and it gives the regulator, the SEC, the ability to nurture that innovation, with, the appropriate safeguards. So we're going to talk about closed-end funds next. Now, closed-end funds are also traded on the exchange, like ETFs. But the difference for ETFs is going to be, one, they are typically regulated as open-end funds, so have to comply with the open-end fund liquidity concepts and whatnot. They are still issuing shares and redeeming shares. It's just in the big creation units. Three, most ETFs are transparent, meaning they publish their holdings on a daily basis, intraday, et cetera, in a way that allows those people who are trading on the exchange to know what's in the portfolio, understand what's in the portfolio, is what the value of what is in the portfolio, and then, have appropriate trading prices in terms of being able to, buy and sell. So what it does is it allows that trading price for the ETF to be closer to the actual asset value of all of its pool, you know, of that pool of securities that it owns. So that's a little bit different from a closed-end fund. So a closed-end fund just, you know, spits out shares in an IPO. You usually have a syndicate of 30 banks, and it's run very much like any other corporate offering. So it might raise $1 billion, it might raise $5 billion. And then those shares are issued and they trade on the exchange. Typically, you're not buying or selling any shares from this closed-end fund ever again. It might do secondary offerings, but doesn't have to. Now, what happens there is those shares typically trade at what we call a discount to their net asset value. So again, the net asset value is the value of the pool of securities that the fund owns. And so you've got, you know, that dollar amount divided by the number of shares outstanding, that's your net asset value. But then you also have a market value per share, which is what you're trading it at on the exchange. And oftentimes that is less than the net asset value. And, you know, the closed end funds don't, you know, have the daily or intraday transparency into their portfolio to the public that ETFs do. So that's one thing that can contribute to that trading discount when you're only publishing your portfolio on a quarterly basis with a 60-day lag, which is what people do. So there's no liquidity restriction in closed-end funds because they don't have to meet redemptions. So they can be invested in 100% illiquid assets. They can go make loans to, you know, middle market private companies, and they don't have to, you know, worry about liquidity there. I'm going to kind of breeze through a few of these since we've only got about 5 minutes left, and I want to make sure that we touch on just a few other points here. So there's also another kind of closed-end fund called a business development company. You know, this is a little bit beyond the scope. And if you're interested in it, we've got a few slides on it in here that I encourage you to take a look at. But the business development companies are, for the most part, also exchange traded products that typically what they do is they originate loans to middle market companies, and they're kind of highly leveraged and quite, you know, risky in terms of the investments that they make, but bigger risk equals bigger reward, but also bigger risk equals bigger losses in a down market. BDCs are interesting, and they've kind of got their own little statute within the 40 Act. So what the Investment Company Act does is it exempts BDCs from all of the 40 Act, and then it reads back in certain portions of it and says, you know, notwithstanding the exemption, BDCs are subject to, you know, kind of X, Y, and Z. And then there's also some sections that say, and you're, you know, subject to A, B, and C with the following modifications. So it's an interesting and complicated product that, you know, once you've got a very solid base in, you know, call it closed end funds and open end funds, you know, it does make a lot of sense once you start looking at it and you say, oh, okay, like, you know, it's basically like this, except with these other little modifications. And one of those modifications is, of course, relaxed affiliated transaction rules, which we've noted here on this slide. So I would be remiss without touching on alternative closed-end funds as well. So these are closed-end funds that kind of seek to act like mutual funds. So I call them, you know, semi-liquid. They're kind of meant for, you know, retail investors like you and me to be able to access private markets that we couldn't access otherwise, because, you know, we can't diversify enough, or we're not, you know, sufficiently qualified investors. So, you know, there's a couple names of these funds you might hear about: interval funds, tender offer funds. And what these are closed end funds that are not listed yet give people a periodic basis on which they can get out of the fund through a tender offer or through a repurchase offer. And you know, these funds have gotten much more popular over the course of the past 3 or 4 years because remember those closed-end fund IPOs we talked about? The market just hasn't been supporting them over the course of the past 3 or 4 years. So in terms of where is product going in order to, you know, kind of provide those investment strategies to you and me as retail investors, it's been in these alternative closed-end funds. So if you practice in the area, I imagine you will start to hear about those. So I think we've got 3 minutes left. I know this, I think it's worth it to talk a little bit more about the board of directors and kind of what exactly they have to approve and why it's important. So I don't know, Lauren, if you wanted to, you know, kind of say a few more words about some of the details in terms of the board. Happy to cede this one to you for a few here.
Yeah, I would say a large part of in-house practice is managing all of the information and things that the board needs in order for them to be able to approve all the different contracts that you have listed here. So I think we already talked about the fact that the board has to have a majority independent directors from a statutory requirement. It's actually 40%, but there are other exempt rules under the 40 Act that actually require more, which is how you get to the majority. And the reason you need a majority of independent directors is because you need independent directors to approve a whole host of the contractual arrangements that we talked about earlier. So the investment advisory contracts with advisors and sub-advisors, the underwriting contracts, right, to distribute the fund. We didn't talk about auditors, but the independent trustees have to approve the fund's auditors who are auditing the fund's financial statements, which is included, information is included in the registration statement from those financials. And then there are a variety of other things that the board has to approve on a periodic basis, including 12B1 plans and other matters. So if you don't have an independent board, you don't have anyone who can approve all of these different items that need approval, which means that you can't run your fund. Right. So the board's independence is incredibly, incredibly important so that they can oversee and approve on an ongoing basis all of these arrangements that your fund needs in order to operate on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, absolutely. And then like with the last 30 seconds, I just want to touch on the advisory contract approval, which is an incredibly important function of the board, as Lauren mentioned. You know, there's several statutory provisions that govern it. In essence, you need to, you know, provide the board and the independent board members with a lot of information about your fund, how it's been run, your advisory fee, how it compares to others' advisory fees, how your performance compares to other performance, how your performance compares to other funds that you run, how your fees compare to other funds that you run. The board can often engage in a multi-meeting process over the course of months in order to review these advisory contracts and make a determination as to whether to continue with the advisor for another year. So important fact, every advisory contract has to be renewed every year. And there's this process around that. And that process has led to quite a bit of litigation under a section of the Investment Company Act that, you know, provides that both the board has a fiduciary duty in approving the contract and that the advisor has a fiduciary duty in terms of providing information to the board for approving that contract. So with that, I think we are out of time. Obviously, the deck is much as I think we got about halfway through the actual deck, but the deck is there for everyone to take a look at your leisure. We put it together so that you have it as a resource if you're interested in investment management practice. And, you know, either of us are always happy to entertain any outreach from anyone who has any questions or is interested in delving farther into the Investment Company Act space. So thank you very much for attending.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion.
Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.